Good evening, brothers and sisters. Well, we finished the previous address in this series by considering the events of Ezra chapter 6, a chapter which described the completion and the dedication of the temple. That notable achievement was followed by a celebration of the Passover. And Ezra 6 concludes with a very encouraging description of the attitude of the returned exiles. Verse 22 reads, "And they kept the feast of unleavened bread 7 days with joy, for the Lord made them joyful, and turned the heart of the king of Assyria toward them, to strengthen their hands in the work of the house of God, the God of Israel." So God had used the benevolence of the Persian kings and the encouragement of the prophets Haggai and Zechariah to strengthen the returned exiles' resolve in their work for the house of the God of Israel. A key aspect of their work is described in verse 21. "Then the children of Israel who had returned from the captivity ate together with all who had separated themselves from the filth of the nations of the land in order to seek the Lord God of Israel." So we see how those that celebrated the Passover recognised the need to separate themselves from the defiling practices of the surrounding nations. They aspired to be a holy people. But sadly, that aspiration was not to last, for the Jews once again corrupted their way by adopting the practices of the nations. Ezra 9 verse 1 tells us of the report that was given to Ezra when he arrived in Jerusalem. This is what he was told. "When these things were done, the leaders came to me saying, 'The people of Israel and the priests and the Levites have not separated themselves from the peoples of the lands with respect to the abominations of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Jebusites, the Ammonites, the Moabites, the Egyptians and the Amorites.'" What is notable from that verse is that the priests and the Levites were complicit in this departure from God's command. Indeed, as verse 2 goes on to emphasise, the hand of the leaders and the rulers has been foremost in this trespass. So the rulers, priests and Levites, the ones who carried the primary responsibility for teaching the law of the Lord and confirming that instruction by their own example, they were responsible for leading the people astray. But as we know, God never leaves his people without witness. And so, a true and able teacher was raised up to encourage reformation in Israel. And so we read in Ezra chapter 7 and verse 6, "Ezra came up from Babylon, and he was a skilled scribe in the law of Moses, which the Lord God of Israel had given." But what is not at all clear from reading the narrative in Ezra is the time that elapsed between the happy picture painted at the end of chapter 6 and the depressing situation that Ezra found on his return at the beginning of chapter 7. That there is an interval is implied by the opening words of Ezra 7, "Now after these things." But this interval is not just a matter of months or even years. Most commentators agree that the interval was something between 50 and 60 years. The uncertainty arises over the identity of the Persian king that sponsored Ezra's return. Verse 11 of Ezra chapter 7 identifies him as Artaxerxes. But the problem is that three Persian kings carried that name, and it's a bit of detective work to find out which one of those is referred to in the scriptural narrative. So at this point I want to divert a little to spend some time setting the chronological framework for the return from exile, in order that we can appreciate how the events of Ezra, Nehemiah and Esther fit together. Is that clear enough with all the lights on? Yeah? Just the front row, that's fine, Don, I think. So this first slide shows the period of history we're concerned with, the bar chart at the top showing the time from around 550 BC through to 350 BC. And the green boxes below show the reigns of the Persian kings who bear upon our narrative. And our aim is to try and use the scriptures to superimpose on this timeline the key events of the period of Ezra and Nehemiah. And I've got a few handouts at the front for those of you who want a copy of the final version of this as we build it up. Well, we can begin by establishing a few dates that are known with some certainty. We know that the first wave of exiles returned under Zerubbabel and Joshua, following the decree issued in the first year of Cyrus. This is generally accepted as being in 536 BC. We also know that the temple was dedicated in the sixth year of the reign of Darius, which again could be dated with reasonable confidence as 515 BC. As we mentioned earlier, the problems arise when we try and date Ezra and Nehemiah's work, since these are given relative to the reign of Artaxerxes, and we have to do some detective work to identify which of those three Artaxerxes is intended. Well, Nehemiah chapter 13 and verse 6 tells us that Nehemiah was recalled to Persia in the 32nd year of the king's reign. So the Artaxerxes that we're concerned with must be one who reigned for at least 32 years. And that rules out Artaxerxes III, since he only reigned for 21 years. Now we can get a probable fix on which of the other two Artaxerxes is referred to by reference to Daniel's prophecy of the 70 weeks. So let's try Artaxerxes II to begin with. That prophecy of the 70 weeks states that, "Know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the command to restore and build Jerusalem until Messiah the Prince, there shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. The street shall be built again and the wall, even in troublesome times." Well, my first reaction on reading this passage was that since there is reference to rebuilding of the wall, the command to restore and rebuild referred to the permission granted by Artaxerxes to Nehemiah in the 20th year of the king's reign, as we see on the chart. Well, the interval between the issuing of the command and Messiah the Prince was to be 69 weeks. Well, we haven't got time this evening to debate the meaning of a week, but for tonight's purpose, we will accept that a week refers to a period of 7 years. So 69 weeks amounts to a period of 483 years. Well, Artaxerxes II came to the throne in 404 BC. So the 20th year of his reign would be 384 BC, and adding 483 years to this would bring us to around 100 AD, which is way beyond the lifespan of the life and work of Christ. This seems to eliminate Artaxerxes II as a candidate. That leaves us with Artaxerxes I, and if we do a similar calculation, it brings us to AD 38, which is a much more realistic date, but it still falls some time after Jesus' ministry was over. Well, our confidence in the accuracy of the scriptures suggests that we still haven't got something quite right. Well, careful reading of the narrative shows that although Nehemiah received permission from Artaxerxes to return and was also given authority to demand timber from the king's forest, there was no formal command or royal decree, something that Daniel's prophecy seems to require. In contrast, when Ezra returned in the 7th year of Artaxerxes, he carried with him a letter that did indeed contain a royal decree. This is recorded in Ezra 7, which we shall read later. "This is a copy of the letter that King Artaxerxes gave Ezra the priest, the scribe, expert in the words of the commandments of the Lord and of his statutes to Israel. Artaxerxes, king of kings, to Ezra the priest, a scribe of the law of the God of heaven, perfect peace and so forth. I issue a decree that all those of the people of Israel and the priests and the Levites in my realm who volunteer to go up to Jerusalem may go with you." This occasion of Ezra's departure was some 13 years before Nehemiah, And using the same calculation as before, the giving of this decree would bring the target date for the appearance of Messiah the Prince to AD 25. Well, that is the year that conventional chronology says that Jesus was about 30 years of age, the time that Luke 3:23 informs us that Jesus began his ministry. So these facts seem to fit together, suggesting the date of the beginning of the 70 weeks prophecy. But what about the reference in the prophecy to the rebuilding of the wall? Again, careful scrutiny says that the command was much more general. It was to restore and build Jerusalem. And indeed, the reference to the street and the wall being built seems to be a consequence of this initial restoration work. The decree granted to Ezra does not specifically mention rebuilding the wall, but it certainly involved the restoration of Jerusalem. Restoration as an active site for the worship of the God of Israel. Ezra 7 records the king's clear command. Now therefore, be careful to buy with this money bulls, rams and lambs with their grain offerings and their drink offerings, and offer them on the altar of the house of your God in Jerusalem. But as well as sanctioning the revival of the temple services, Artaxerxes gives Ezra a remarkably free hand to do whatever he thought was necessary. Whatever seems good to you and your brethren to do with the rest of the silver and the gold, do it according to the will of your God. Whether that free rein resulted in any general construction work is not stated. But Ezra's reforms not only restored the temple services, they also led to the Jews separating themselves from the other nations who were living in the land. And this act probably provoked the antagonism of the Samaritans, leading to the open hostility of Sanballat, Tobiah and their allies. Daniel's prophecy predicted that the street and the wall shall be built again, even in troublesome times. And that description resonates well with the picture that was relayed to Nehemiah, which prompted him to act. This was the report that he received. The survivors who are left from the captivity in the province are there in great distress and reproach. The wall of Jerusalem is also broken down, and its gates are burned with fire. It therefore seems the most likely that the decree given to Ezra marked the start of the prophecy of the 70 weeks. That being so, Ezra returned in 458 BC, with Nehemiah following in 445 BC. But there remains an unanswered question. Why was Artaxerxes so favourably disposed to both Ezra and Nehemiah? We are familiar with Nehemiah's role as the king's cupbearer, but it seems that Ezra also had direct access to an audience with the king. Ezra chapter 8 explains how the exiles fasted before making the arduous journey back to Israel. And verse 22 gives the reason. For I, Ezra, was ashamed to request of the king an escort of soldiers and horsemen to help us against the enemy on the road, because we had spoken to the king, saying, the hand of our God is upon all those for good who seek him, but his power and his wrath are against all those who forsake him. So Ezra had had direct conversation with the king. The fact that Ezra had spoken to the king is surely reinforced by the glowing testimonial given to Ezra in the king's letter, which is recorded in Ezra chapter 7. This is the more remarkable given the fact that access to the king was by invitation only, as Esther 4:11 makes plain. Any man or woman who goes into the inner court to the king who has not been called, he has but one law: put all to death, except the one to whom the king holds out the golden scepter. Well, this apparently easy relationship between the Persian king and both Ezra and Nehemiah has led to the suggestion that the reigning queen at the time was Esther, especially given the reference in chapter 2 and verse 6. That passage records the discussion between the king and his cupbearer after Nehemiah had made his request to return. It reads, "Then the king said to me, the queen also sitting beside him, "How long will your journey be, and when will you return?" So it pleased the king to send me, and I set him a time. And the question is asked, what is the point of the reference to the queen, unless she had some influence over the outcome? And Esther would have just such an influence. Well, an initial objection to this idea is that Ezra and Nehemiah, as we have seen, were commissioned by Artaxerxes, whereas Esther's king was Ahasuerus. In fact, this is not a problem because Ahasuerus is not a name but a title, rather like Pharaoh or Tsar. The Septuagint, prepared in the period 300 to 200, which translated the Old Testament from Hebrew into Greek, identifies the king of the Book of Esther as Artaxerxes. And given the translation work was done only 200 years after the events of Esther, it seems to me that such an identification is likely to be fairly reliable. That identification of Ahasuerus with Artaxerxes I is also supported by Josephus. But despite this, most commentators identify Ahasuerus with Xerxes, the father of Artaxerxes. The main evidence for this is the timing of the events given in Esther. Firstly, there is the great banquet of chapter 1, which we are told is held in the king's third year. Well, history records that Xerxes held a great council of war in his third year to prepare his plans for the invasion of Greece. And the ensuing military campaign against Greece lasted for 4 years, and such a campaign explains the otherwise unlikely delay of 4 years before a successor to Vashti was appointed. For Esther was not made queen until, we're told, the 7th year of the king's reign. There is one line of scriptural evidence suggesting that Ahasuerus was indeed king before Artaxerxes came to the throne. In Ezra 4, we have a record of the various letters sent from the province to the Persian monarchs. Verse 6 tells us that in the reign of Ahasuerus, in the beginning of his reign, the people of the land wrote an accusation against the inhabitants of Judah and Jerusalem. So there we have a letter written in the reign of Ahasuerus. And then in the days of Artaxerxes also, they wrote to Artaxerxes, king of Persia. This implies that Ahasuerus predates Artaxerxes, something that would be consistent with identifying Ahasuerus with Xerxes. Well, the evidence is not strong, particularly in either direction. But even if Xerxes is the correct one, it is distinctly possible that Artaxerxes would have been influenced by his father's favourite wife and by Mordecai, his trusted counsellor. The closing verse of Esther describes Mordecai's influence in the Persian court, and it seems to echo very much the letter that Artaxerxes gave to Ezra. For Mordecai the Jew was second to King Ahasuerus, and was great among the Jews and well received by the multitude of his brethren, seeking the good of his people and speaking peace to all his countrymen. Thus we have managed to build up the chronology of the period as shown in the chart. We noted that the temple was dedicated in the days of Haggai and Zechariah in 515 BC and that Ezra arrived in 458 BC. So there is a gap of 57 years between the end of Ezra chapter 6 and the beginning of chapter 7. The encouragement to complete the work on the temple had been inspired by the prophetic witness of Haggai and Zechariah. That prophetic witness was not replaced, and the returned exiles were left to their own devices to see if they would continue in the commitment that they had made, as recorded in Ezra 6, to strengthen their hands in the work of the house of God. But sadly, history shows the same pattern as we see in the book of Judges. When the men raised up by God disappeared from the scene, the people slipped back into wanting to be like the surrounding nations, rather than aspiring to be holy like their God. And although there was no God-appointed prophet or teacher in this period, it was not that the Jews had no evidence of the hand of God at work in their lives. As we have seen, the story of Esther occurs during this period of silence. Both Jews and Samaritans living in the province of beyond the river would have received a copy of the decree inspired by Haman. For letters were sent by couriers into all the king's provinces to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all the Jews, both young and old, little children and women, in one day, on the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month Adar. Doubtless the receipt of this decree was the cause of much jubilation to Sanballat and his cronies. But as we know, through the intervention of Esther, a second decree was issued so that the Jews who were in every city could gather together and protect their lives and to destroy, kill and annihilate all the forces of any people or province that would assault them. The returned exiles therefore had the strongest evidence of God's work, of God at work in their lives. They had seen the unseen hand of providence moving among the nations. But even so, the Jews slipped back from the standards that God required of them. And in this there is, of course, a sobering lesson for us. Just like the Jews of Ezra's time, we have no active prophetic witness, but we do have the same evidence of God's providential care. The Jews had slipped back into unfaithfulness, but God is ever faithful and gracious. And so he raised up another man to teach and instruct his people in the ways of righteousness. Thus it was that after these things, in the reign of Artaxerxes, king of Persia, Ezra, the son of Sariah, came up from Babylon, and he was a skilled scribe in the law of Moses, which the Lord God of Israel had given. And at this point, I'd like to ask Brother Mark to read for us Ezra chapter 7.
So although we always think of Ezra as the scribe, the genealogy that we read at the beginning of chapter 7 there indicates that Ezra was indeed a priest in direct descent from Aaron through Zadok, who was the high priest who ministered in the Temple of Solomon. He's also described as the son of Sariah, who the second book of Kings tells us was chief priest when Nebuchadnezzar took the city and destroyed the temple. Thus Ezra had a distinguished pedigree and maybe was even high priest himself. That would be consistent with the injunction of the king in the letter of authority that he gave Ezra. Be careful to buy with this money bulls, rams and lambs, with their grain offerings and their drink offerings, and offer them on the altar of the house of your God in Jerusalem. But the primary responsibility of the priest was much more to do with teaching than it was to do with the offering of sacrifice. As we shall explore in a later study, God willing, Malachi was the prophet contemporary with Ezra, and especially with Nehemiah. And the following words from Malachi emphasize this teaching role. He said, "For the lips of a priest ought to preserve knowledge, because he is the messenger of the Lord Almighty, and people seek instruction from his mouth." And it is perhaps for this reason that the record gives greater emphasis to the fact that Ezra was a skilled scribe in the law of Moses, which the Lord God of Israel had given. And Ezra 7 verse 10 describes how seriously Ezra regarded this responsibility. It tells us that Ezra had prepared his heart to seek the law of the Lord, and to do it, and to teach statutes and ordinances in Israel. I find this one of the most powerful exhortations in the whole of the scriptures, for it describes the process that all God-fearing people must go through. First must come the preparation of the heart, the attitude that says God's law must come before human reasoning or self-interest. Having made that decision, there must follow the active seeking out of the mind and the will of God. The God-centered life is not a passive existence. He must seek out, and then, like Ezra, that knowledge has to find expression in action. For as we read, he sought the law of the Lord and did it. And as that verse goes on to reveal, it is not enough to know and to do it ourselves. We have responsibility to encourage others in following the same path. By word, but particularly by example, we must teach the statutes and ordinances of God, so that others too will be encouraged to prepare their hearts to seek the Lord. What an example Ezra is in this, and how different to the scribes of the days of Jesus, to whom he applied the prophecy of Isaiah. This people honours me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. The next point I'd like to note comes from the latter part of Ezra chapter 7 and verse 6. It explains how the king granted him, Ezra, all his requests according to the hand of the Lord his God upon him. It's intriguing to inquire as to how Ezra made his request known to the king. As we've already noted, audience with the king was by invitation only. Perhaps Esther had a part to play, but because Ezra was the reigning high priest, maybe he was recognised by the Persian authorities as the de facto leader of the Jews. Ezra would therefore be the person to speak to in matters of Jewish-Persian relationships. But it is also interesting to see how the king seems very conscious of his position before Ezra's God. Look at Ezra chapter 7 and verse 23. These are the words of the king. Whatever is commanded by the God of heaven, let it diligently be done for the house of the God of heaven. For why should there be wrath against the realm of the king and his sons? Note particularly how the king writes, not about the God of the Jews, nor the God of the territory beyond the river. The king uses the phrase, the God of heaven. And the context shows that the king recognised the power of the God of heaven, who could bring wrath against the realm of the king and of his sons. Such respect for Ezra's God prompted the king to show great benevolence to Ezra's request. Artaxerxes' letter of authority spells out three elements that must have been the basis of Ezra's request. Firstly, from chapter 7 and verse 13, we see that any exiles who were so moved would be allowed to return. I issue a decree that all those of the people of Israel and the priests and Levites in my realm who volunteer to go up to Jerusalem may go with you. Secondly, verse 17 required Ezra to reinstitute the temple sacrifices. Be sure to buy bulls, rams and male lambs, together with their grain offerings and drink offerings, and sacrifice them on the altar of the temple of your God in Jerusalem. And thirdly, verse 25, we learn that Ezra was granted permission to actively promote the law of God. And you, Ezra, according to your God-given wisdom, set magistrates and judges, who may judge all the people who are in the region beyond the river, all such as know the laws of your God, and teach those who do not know them. The granting of these three requests were supplemented by freewill gifts from the king and his counsellors. This we see from verse 15. You are to carry the silver and the gold, which the king and his counsellors have freely offered to the God of Israel, whose dwelling is in Jerusalem. And this royal donation was to be supplemented by permission to make demands of the provincial treasury, as we see from Ezra 7 verse 21. Now I, King Artaxerxes, decree that all the treasurers of Trans-Euphrates are to provide with diligence whatever Ezra the priest, the teacher of the law of the God of heaven, may ask of you. But I think even more remarkable was the decree given in verse 24. Also we inform you that it shall not be lawful to impose tax, tribute or custom on any of the priests, Levites, singers, gatekeepers, Nethinim, or servants of this house of God. Effectively, this freedom from paying tribute meant that those who served in the temple were no longer to be regarded as subject people. By any reckoning, these things show a remarkably benevolent attitude from a supreme monarch towards a subject people. Little wonder then that Ezra was prompted to exclaim, "Blessed be the Lord God of our fathers, who has put such a thing as this in the king's heart, to beautify the house of the Lord which is in Jerusalem, and has extended mercy to me before the king and his counsellors, and before all the king's mighty princes." So I was encouraged, as the hand of the Lord my God was upon me. Well, Ezra had first prepared his heart to seek the Lord, and as a result, the Lord had blessed him more than he probably dared to expect. This encouraged Ezra to fully commit to the task that lay ahead of him. And it is clear that in so doing, he was constantly aware of God's overruling control of his affairs. Just notice how frequently this awareness is expressed in chapters 7 and 8 that deal with the process of organising the return and making the journey. In Ezra chapter 7 we read, for example, verse 6, "The king granted him all his request, according to the hand of the Lord his God upon him." Verse 9, "On the first day of the first month he began his journey from Babylon, and on the first day of the fifth month he came to Jerusalem, according to the good hand of his God upon him." Then in chapter 8, verse 18, "Then by the good hand of our God upon us, they brought us a man of understanding." Verse 22, "I was ashamed to request of the king an escort of soldiers and horsemen to help us against the enemy on the road, because we had spoken to the king, saying, the hand of our God is upon us, upon all those for good who seek him." Then in verse 31, "We departed from the river of Ahava on the 12th day of the first month to go to Jerusalem. And the hand of our God was upon us, and he delivered us up from the hand of the enemy and from ambush along the road." He was very aware of the presence of God in his life. Having obtained the support of the king of Persia, and even more importantly, the blessing of the God of Israel, Ezra was ready to begin his mission. And Ezra 7 closes with yet another hand of the Lord passage. "So I was encouraged as the hand of the Lord my God was upon me, and I gathered leading men of Israel to go up with me." And so we move into chapter 8, which deals with the organisation of the return party, their preparations, and the making of the journey. The response to the invitation to leave was muted in the extreme. Only 1,500 volunteers are listed amongst the names given in verses 1 to 13 of chapter 8. In contrast, over 42,000 made the earlier return with Zerubbabel. However, these few volunteers assembled together at the Ahava River, and it was there that an extra dimension to the problem of the lack of volunteers manifested itself. The key aspect of Ezra's mission was to fully restore the temple services. And a building, no matter how elegant its design, and irrespective of how beautifully it is decorated, is only an empty shell. It needs the activities for which it was designed to bring it to life. And the achievement of that objective depended on there being available sufficient Levites to do the work. Ezra took a roll call of the volunteers, and to his dismay, verse 15 says, "I looked among the people and the priests and found none of the sons of Levi there." Well, I think many men would take this lack of Levites as a sign that good intentions cannot always be realised. But Ezra was made of stern stuff. If a general appeal had fallen on deaf ears, he would make a more direct approach. And verse 16 explains how he organised a delegation of 11 men to make this approach. 9 of these are described as leaders, presumably the heads of their tribal clans. 2 additional men were appointed. Verse 16 describes Joarib and Elnathan as men of understanding. Presumably they were the diplomats who were to lead the negotiations. Verse 17 explains how Ezra briefed them very carefully. "And I gave them a command for Iddo, the chief man of the place Cassiphiah, and I told them what they should say to Iddo and his brethren the Nethinim at the place Cassiphiah, that they should bring us servants for the house of our God." Well, who are the Nethinim? The word Nethinim is derived from the Hebrew word for given, and it is generally used in the Old Testament to describe foreign captives who were given to the service of the tabernacle. The classic example of this are the Gibeonites in the days of Joshua. Their crafty deception saved them from destruction, But Joshua explained how that Joshua made them woodcutters and water carriers for the congregation and for the altar of the Lord. Well, although the men dwelling at Cassiphiah clearly included such Gentile temple servants, it may be that the place was also a city where Levites dwell. We should remember that the Levites were given to the service of Aaron, and so in fact they were the first Nethinim. But whether or not the Levites were included in the generic term, or whether they were spurred into response by the Gentile temple servants from Cassiphiah, the delegation achieved Ezra's objective. 38 Levites and 220 Nethinim joined the party of returning exiles. Amongst them was a Levite named Sherebiah, described as a man of understanding. The lexicon amplifies the meaning of that word to encompass characteristics of prudence, insight, and good sense. As Ezra acknowledged, God's hand had again blessed their mission, for Ezra now had an invaluable assistant to help him organise the temple services. The party was now complete, and the dangerous journey back to the land could begin. But it is at this point that we see the character of Ezra fully revealed. After the delays caused by the missing Levites, most of us would want to be pressing on with the journey, making up for lost time. Not so with Ezra. As verse 21 explains, "Then I proclaimed a fast there at the river of Ahava, that we might humble ourselves before our God." In the natural course of events, fasting is not the best preparation for making a long, arduous and dangerous journey. But to Ezra and his fellow travellers, men and women who had prepared their hearts to seek the Lord, fasting and prayer were the means of seeking the continued blessings of God on their venture. Verse 21 continues by explaining the focus of their supplications. It was to seek from him the right way for us and our little ones and all our possessions, for I was ashamed to request of the king an escort of soldiers. And danger from enemies on the road were very real, especially given the array of riches that they took with them. 650 talents of silver, silver articles weighing 100 talents, 100 talents of gold, 20 gold basins worth 1,000 drachmas, and 2 vessels of fine polished bronze, precious as gold. Yet it would seem that on the journey the presence of the angels was much more apparent than any threat from thieves or brigands. Verse 31 tells us, "We departed from the river of Ahava on the 12th day of the first month to go to Jerusalem. And the hand of our God was upon us, and he delivered us from the hand of the enemy and from ambush along the road." The timing of their departure also seems significant. It was the time of Passover. The lamb was selected from the flock on the 10th day of the first month, and the feast celebrated on the 14th day. Ezra's party left on the 12th day. And surely the significance of Passover would have extra meaning to the returning exiles. The law that Ezra studied had declared, "We were slaves of Pharaoh in Egypt, and the Lord brought us out with a mighty hand, and the Lord showed signs and wonders before our eyes." Well, that mighty hand was at work again, bringing freedom to God's people. And so the journey was accomplished, seemingly without incident. Ezra 8:32 records, "So we came to Jerusalem and stayed there 3 days." Somehow I doubt that these 3 days were for rest and recuperation, for the 3 days mirror the 3 days spent at Ahava before they set forth. Just as those original 3 days were days of preparation, supplication and fasting, so surely the 3 days after arriving in Jerusalem were days of praise and thanksgiving. As with the date of their departure, the timing of their arrival would invoke particular thoughts. Ezra 7 verse 9 explains that it was on the first day of the fifth month that Ezra came to Jerusalem. Well, it was in that same fifth month of the year that Jeremiah tells us the Babylonians burned the house of the Lord. The timing was another reminder of Jeremiah's prophecy that after 70 years are completed at Babylon, I will visit you and perform my good word toward you and cause you to return to this place. And what is interesting is that it seems that the Jews have been keeping a series of fasts that commemorated the various stages in the destruction of Jerusalem and its temple. The prophet Zechariah had spoken of their fasting and mourning on these occasions, but he instructed a change of attitude. They were not to look back to mourn the calamities of their history, but look forward to the new opportunities afforded by their new start in the land. So Zechariah exhorted them, "Thus says the Lord of hosts, the fast of the fourth month, the fast of the fifth, the fast of the seventh, and the fast of the tenth, shall be joy and gladness and cheerful feasts for the house of Judah. Therefore love, truth and peace." And so it was that immediately on their return, Ezra, Sherebiah and their fellow travellers could join the celebrations of the feast of the fifth month as a time of joy, of gladness and thankfulness. Ezra had thus arrived in the city and the real work was about to begin. And that is what we will look at next time, God willing.